The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the 1850s, California newspapers dismissed Chinese immigrants, writing that they had most of the vices and few of the virtues of the African. In that state, before 1940, not only did Asian Americans earn less than whites, they also learned less than African Americans. That changed in just a few generations.
Do we have Asian privilege in America? Because the truth is that Asian American households earn far more money than anyone else. So the question becomes, why? And the answer is found in stable homes and an emphasis on education.
That's Fox News host Bill O'Reilly adding his spin on why Asian Americans now out-earn all other racial minority groups in America. Nate Hilger, an economist at Brown University, has a different take. The nation became less racist towards Asian Americans. And Nate, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Asian Americans were considered at the bottom of the barrel in late 19th into the early 20th century. When did that shift?
It's hard to know exactly when it shifted. After World War II, between 1940 and 1970, 1980, it seems like there was some kind of sea change in attitudes and laws towards Asian Americans. And I should emphasize that my paper is focused entirely on California. I do not think it's particularly illuminating to compare Asian Americans and other races throughout the country because Asians have a very distinct geographic legacy. They largely arrived in California and they largely stayed in California until well into the later half of the 20th century. So in California, starting in, after World War II, there were a lot of state and federal Supreme Court cases and ballot propositions and patterns in interracial marriage that all suggest after around 1940, white society became more tolerant and accepting of Asians and allowed them to be compensated for the skills that they brought to the labor market.
Well, another thing that's often brought up is this idea of the model minority, which we heard reflected from Bill O'Reilly, that education being a priority above all else, strong family values. What did you find in your research as far as that model minority goes?
Yeah, well, I found that Asians do exhibit, some of the Asian advantage in terms of low-income parents investing more in education than you would predict based on their low income. Some of that is an artifact of just Asians living in California historically. California had an unusually egalitarian and high quality education system. And the vast majority of Asians were fortunate enough to live in this state. I also found that after 1940, Asians do start to exhibit an educational advantage. Lower income Asians do invest a bit more in education than both blacks and whites in California, among families that have children in California. And that did contribute somewhat to Asians' unusual upward economic mobility. But the more important factor was that Asians started to be compensated for the skills that they already had in the early 20th century. In the early 20th century, Asians had higher education than blacks, and they had high skill levels measured by World War II Army enlistment tests. But they were still massively underpaid. They were paid like blacks, despite their very different skill levels from blacks, which is a function of, their very different history from blacks in the United States. And after 1940, Asians started to be paid for these high skill levels. And even if Asians hadn't invested in education in a very different way from blacks and whites in California, they would have wound up converging in their incomes to whites. So I think that's a very different sort of view of Asian American economic upward mobility.
Yeah, I want to get to that, the difference in African American pay and progress. But first, to this idea of the compensation becoming equal, which reflects a difference in racial attitudes. Now, it's difficult to measure racial attitudes. So how did you find that? How did you source that for evidence of changing attitudes?
Yeah, so that is very interesting. I actually, in my paper, I don't have good data on prejudice changing over the 20th century. I think after the 1940s and 50s, it becomes harder to measure prejudice because, at least directly from surveys, because you can't just ask people, you know, are you racist against XYZ group? Because people no longer feel comfortable answering these questions. However, in the early 20th century, people did feel much more comfortable answering these types of questions. And it turned out that there was a large literature in social psychology which asked, you know, thousands of people all across the United States and some in Canada how they felt about Japanese Americans and Chinese Americans and African Americans and Swedish and, you know, Mexican Americans. And they asked people to give their willingness to become socially close with or their preference to spend, you know, time with all these different ethnic groups. And I gathered 23 different samples from 10 different studies published in the 1920s and 30s. And what you find is that all of these studies, when they ask people these questions about their racial preferences and racial prejudices, they find that African Americans, Chinese Americans, and Japanese Americans wind up near the bottom of the list in sample after sample. And for the two samples that I had on the West Coast, Japanese and Chinese Americans do even worse than African Americans. So this is sort of one piece of the paper showing that prejudice against Asian Americans as measured from direct survey data looks very strong in the early 20th century. I don't trust survey data like that after World War II. What you see after World War II is you see laws changing. You see voters. There was a ballot proposition in 1946 to strengthen anti-alien land laws. And whereas a similar ballot proposition had received overwhelming electoral support in California, which is, you know, and this ballot proposition can be interpreted as, you know, an expression of animosity towards Japanese Americans. And a similar ballot proposition in 1920 received 75% of the vote, whereas in 1946 it failed and it only received well under 50% of the vote. So I can't look at survey data changing over time on racial preferences, but I can show you that prejudice against Asian Americans and blacks was very intense in the early 20th century, and that through other measures, this prejudice appears to have declined between 1940 and 1970.
Nate Hilger is with us. He's an economist at Brown University and author of a study about Asian American upward mobility. It's the only non-white U.S. racial group to experience long-term institutional discrimination, yet today exhibits really high income, more than other minorities, and also white people of the same educational level. Why, then, do you think that Asian Americans have been able to close the wage gap while African Americans have historically not?
Okay, so this is a bit of a misperception of my paper, I think. I don't show that racism against Asians stopped and racism against blacks continued. That's not what my paper shows. I think there are many reasons to think that the labor market became more open to, minorities. Some of the more, you know, institutional forms of discrimination in laws and, you know, monolithic customs kind of declined in the decades after World War II, and I discussed that in more detail in the paper. The reason why I think this more open environment allowed Asians to pull ahead faster than blacks, as well as Native Americans, and also Mexican Americans, is because of Asian Americans' different historical legacy in the U.S. America expressed its racial hostility towards Asians by refusing to allow the vast majority of Asians into the country, and by refusing to allow many Asians to bring their spouses over from China and Japan and start families in the U.S. And these laws had a very pro-skill bias. They only allowed Asians to come and start families in the U.S. if they were merchants, which required you to have wealth and literacy and numeracy. And only a tiny fraction of Asian Americans in the early 20th century started families in the U.S. And the Asian Americans who did start families tended to have much higher skills than the Asians who did not start families. And all of this has led to Asian Americans having, you know, as of 1940, even at that early stage, for cohorts born in the 1920s, Asians exhibit very high levels of skill in achievement, you know, academic achievement tests. And I think that reflects, you know, in contrast, in extreme, you know, radical contrast, African Americans and Native Americans, they were forced to come to the U.S., you know, and they were or to join the U.S. nationality, and then they were excluded from the education system for generation after generation. And I think this had an adverse effect on the ability of these groups to accumulate literacy and numeracy and educational skills. And I think after 1940, when the labor market became more open in California, blacks still had an underlying problem of this legacy of educational discrimination. They couldn't just go into the labor market and say, okay, now that you're willing to hire minority engineers and minority doctors and minority managers, we're not. You're still not necessarily going to hire us because of this historical legacy. Whereas Asian Americans, because of their historical legacy, which favored higher skills, could, you know, start applying for jobs as managers and engineers and doctors and lawyers, and that was a faster transition as a result of their very different historical legacy.
That you did your research in California, and there are many people of Asian American descent working in Silicon Valley and doing amazing work, as there are in other high-level positions, both in California and across the nation. How did this softening of discrimination against Asian Americans enable that to happen today?
Well, what we see in the 1940s is already Asian Americans had high skills, and yet they still had low earnings. And I think that that's a key part of the paper, is showing that that most likely, this the by far most common sense clear explanation of that is that Asians were not allowed to make their full contribution, but the, you know, the struggle for equal rights and equal opportunity of both blacks and Asian Americans and the changes in attitudes of whites altogether led to, you know, the kind of shift that allowed more minorities to make their full contribution. And I think Silicon Valley would be a much less productive, less rich place without the contributions of Asian Americans and other minorities and immigrants who have historically experienced such high levels of discrimination that, you know, previously they would not have been able to make these contributions. So I think this, you know, Silicon Valley is partly reflecting dividends of America's greater tolerance to allowing minorities to, you know, be equals and make full contributions as productive entrepreneurs and workers and colleagues.
Nate, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Nate Hilger, he's an economist at Brown University and author of Upward Mobility and Discrimination, The Case of Asian Americans. And you'll find a link to the write-up on his study, Upward Mobility and Discrimination, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
And it is time for Overheard. This is our somewhat regular segment when we talk about the things that we are listening to on the radio. And we are so honored today to have NHPR's Morning Edition host, Rick Anley.
The honor is mine, Virginia. Thank you.
Maureen McMurray, our executive producer, is also here with us. And so is senior producer Taylor Quimby. So the gang is all here. Rick, we're starting with you.
Oh, great. Excellent. Virginia, I brought something that it's very short. It's a little clip of something. I don't want to tell you what category it belongs in. I want to play it, and then I want to see if anybody can identify what it is.
Ooh, I love a good mystery.
Mystery right. Sound. Thinking underwater.
Is this a whale song?
Water is not a bad a bad clue.
Whale, not a good clue.
This is what it sounds like inside my washing machine.
Maybe it does, but no, that is actually, it's actually a simulated sound of what some scientists at NASA think the oceans of Europa, the moon around Jupiter, would sound like.
Oh.
However, They say that this is inferred from some research they're doing about how the gravitational forces on that moon are so strong, how they move the plates around underneath the supposed ocean we think is there, underneath the ice, and what it could sound like if you kind of brought the frequencies up a bit, because this would be subsonic. So I thought that was a really cool thing to do, and I was reading on space.com about this. They have the sound. And it turns out they didn't do it just because it's really cool sounding, which it is. They did it because they want to find a place to land on Europa.
Oh,
so cool.
Trippy.
Also, yeah. You know, what inspiration, you know, for kids to be listening to now and think, we could get to Jupiter.
Exactly.
When I grow up.
You know, you kind of like when you watch space videos all the time, and I'm kind of addicted to that stuff. I watch it all the time. They always, it's silent, of course, except they always put this inspiring music, beautiful, like, you know, either synthesizer music circa 1982 or a lot of orchestral music. But you always wonder, what would it sound like on these different, you know, planets or moons. And now we have an idea of it. Who knows if this would ever hold up to science, but I think it's really cool that you could imagine what it might sound like on another world.
Yeah, you've just outed yourself as a total space nerd.
I am. I'm a complete space nerd. It's true.
Hold on. I want to hear it again now. Yeah, it sounds like space now.
I mean, you could kind of imagine the aliens calling us, but I don't think that's it.
That's great, Rick. I'm so glad we asked you.
So thank you for letting me share my space geek sound effects with you.
We actually have a space nerd on staff. May I call you that, Taylor?
You can.
Okay.
You can.
What have you got?
I'm a nerd of all sorts. This is not space related, but I did appreciate that, Rick. This actually has to do with an interview we just had on Word of Mouth recently, Eva Hoffman, who wrote a book called How to Be Bored. It's from this really cool series called The School of Life, which does philosophy texts that are sort of not for people who are really into actual philosophy texts. So they're very accessible books. They're always sort of about topics that we all deal with.
Is this philosophy light?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, we're all philosophers in the school of life. You know what I mean? Let me just play you a little bit of that conversation. This is the author Eva Hoffman talking about why she thinks we need to learn how to be bored.
Well, first of all, I want to say that I don't want to advise anybody to spend their days lounging on a chaise longue in a state of languorous tedium. But what I do want to say is that we have become frightened of any downtime, of moments of being just with ourselves, or of courting something that we might think would be boredom.
So while I was researching for this interview, I ended up producing it. And, you know, often what we'll do is we'll sort of look up previous interviews with the guests that we're going to have on, you know, sort of see how they deal with questions and what people have asked them in the past. It's just like a part of the process. And in doing so, I stumbled on this hour-long interview for a series called Conversation with History that's produced by University of California TV. This is from 2002. And I got to tell you, this is not boring. This is very exciting theme music that opens this thing up.
What a setup. It's 2002?
2002.
It's more like 72, I think. Space.
You can kind of hear the drums.
Kinda.
This is something we might have done in the late 80s on a Casio keyboard.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good.
2002.
Yeah.
This sounds like the Stranger Things theme.
I honestly hear this and it's cheesy, but like this is golden material for people who want to remix stuff.
Yeah,
so
you could.
I discovered this and it's a clear gem, so I want to put it out there in case anybody picks that up and decides to do something cool with it.
All right. Throwing it out there. You got a remix for the, what are we going to call this, Taylor?
2002 A Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
Oh, Maureen, she's so good with
that. That is good. Yeah, I like that.
So this is Overheard. It's our regular segment where we share what we are listening to on the radio. We just heard from Taylor Quimby, possibly the best theme music ever written.
I think so. And Maureen, I think you're next. So you keeping the space theme going?
No, we're going to take an abrupt turn, shift gears here. So my pick for Overheard is a piece by a producer named Sally Herships. You might recognize her name. She actually does a lot of pieces for
Marketplace.
Yes. And she did this piece for Falling Tree Productions. It's from the BBC. And it's a very, very personal story. Her husband leaves her unexpectedly. Just one day sends her an email and is like, this is it. It's over. Don't call me, don't contact me, and never gives her an explanation, just leaves. Mm. And being a reporter, she does the only thing she can think of to comfort herself. She just starts recording herself going through this grieving process of her husband leaving her. And it is a really, really powerful piece. It's beautifully produced. And I'm just going to play a little snippet of it here. And this starts with her recalling their wedding day.
I was the one getting married, and I was nervous. Eventually, I was taken out into the hallway. It was dark, and there was light coming through a tiny slit in the doors. I could hear the announcer. We got inside, and a garland of roses and white carnations was put around my neck. I looked out into the audience. I saw Adnan's family and all the women, his cousins and aunts, in their saris. They were so beautiful. They looked like butterflies. I still think that song is so pretty.
Hey, sorry I missed your call. Call me back. I'm on my cell phone. Bye.
So, okay, clearly I cannot watch love story movies. That is not okay. I just saw a trailer for, what is that, Blue is the Warmest Color, burst into tears, and just had to go to the bathroom to clean up my face. So, not okay. Love stories, not okay.
So I'm just getting home from seeing my friend, and I was just thinking as I walked in the door, it's just incredibly sad to come home late at night alone. I used to walk in and Adnan would be here waiting for me, and it's just so sad. It's just heartbreaking. And I know he is never gonna be here again waiting for me because I changed the locks, so.
Wow.
It's took her a long time to actually, and she talks about it in the piece, to produce it, because this happened over 3 years ago and she's just sitting with all of these tapes and was just incredibly vulnerable with it. And I just think it was really brave of her to share her story. And when you're in the right mood, you should listen to it.
I was going to say, I wonder, I don't know if she alludes to this at all, but after doing that for 3 years, you said, the project went on as she was taping all of this and having to go through it and then edit it and put it together. Did that help her to heal, or did it help just prolong her pain?
It wasn't quite as cathartic as she hoped it would be, is the answer I will give.
But there's no resolution, right?
There's no resolution. She never gets an explanation from him.
It's, you know, I guess I was also listening to someone I've heard as a reporter. It's really interesting. And we have so much manufactured, trumped up emotion in our culture. When you hear somebody really going through something, you know, something so personal that is rarely shared with anybody, especially by someone who has that kind of reserve of a reporter, there's something very penetrating about that. Do you want me to cheer things up?
Yes.
Please.
Sorry, guys. Happy holidays.
It's heavy in here. You guys are heavy.
Yeah, you're pretty deep. You know, if you stayed awake this long in the afternoon.
I'm going back to space.
Okay, so this actually, I'll bring you back to space. This is a site designed by a guy, I guess his name is Jonathan Puckey, and it's called Radio Garden, Transnational Radio. And basically, when you go on the site, there's a globe with a bunch of little teeny green dots, and it's all of the radio stations around the world that are streaming online at any given time. So you just put your mouse on the dots and go.
It's so cool. I've seen this.
You want to play
some? Travel by radio.
Okay.
The forecast. Thursday night, partly cloudy in the evening, then clearing. Lows in the lower 20s. Friday.
Nice Weezer.
So this is in the Gran Canary Islands in Spain.
Really?
The other ones
I was
going to
say was the Bay Area's classic rock leader.
Well, exactly. The previous one was Kansas City, and the other was in Columbus. Then we go to Marrakesh.
It's very cool. It has like a short wave feel to it where you just twist the dial.
Definitely. And that's what it looks like. But you can actually see where they're from. And it also has history and jingles. So this is a talk show, I'm guessing, in Juba, South Sudan. Kampala, Uganda.
I know this track. Oh. It's a little static. Got to have that.
Well, it's static every time you're navigating and you go around. It's a really great little feature. Okay, listen to this one. Самое главное – дело начать. Супермаркет Эротик. Встречайте новый год. Kiev, Russia, Supermarket Erotic.
I was going to say Erotic Supermarket.
Over 300,000 people in Ireland have been severely abused by a partner.
That's in Belfast. And we're going to end at Heart 96.2, North Devon, the voice of the UK. Can you please say that, Rick?
This is 92.6, the Heart, the voice of North Devon.
Well, what I found so interesting about this is, like, you can kind of create a narrative out of any of these. Like, you know, we heard the voices of Sudan, and then you hear the song that was produced for hunger in, where was it, Somalia at that point? I can't remember.
That is a really, that's, I like that whole idea of just being able to kind of cruise around with your mouse. It feels very old school with the shortwave radio.
Yeah, and they even have stuff like, you know, if you look at the New Hampshire feed, they'll have the station that's just like the Keen police scanner. And all sorts of weird stuff. So
and really jingles, neat. Historical jingles. You can go back to old radio stations that maybe you listened to as a kid, and they have the old jingles.
790 WAKY, where the action is.
And it really shows kind of how America has exported our type of radio around the world.
You are so right. There are so many of these kind of morning zoo programs and that sort of, you know, the Kiev version of classic rock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah, very cool, Virginia.
I loved I you could spend hours on this thing.
And to connect everything back, some of those radio waves travel into space.
Oh my god. Rick Anley, I know this is like dinner time for you.
Thank you so much for having me in.
I'm really glad you were here. Taylor Quimby and Maureen McMurray, that was Overheard. We'll have links to all of the sounds that we talked about at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Come on, remixers, bring it on. Well, that is all we have time for today. Music in this episode came to us from Blue Dot Sessions, La Venganza de Chitara, Broke for Free, and Jazar. I'm Virginia Prescott. On behalf of everyone here at the creative team, we are wishing you a happy, joyful, and festive holiday. We'll be back right after Christmas with a week's worth of staff picks, our favorite interviews and stories and podcasts aired on Word of Mouth in 2016. That's beginning Monday at 2, right here on NHPR.